From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is the epicenter, really, of the humanitarian tragedy of the Congo. Perhaps the worst in the world for this last decade. These women and children have been abused, have been raped, have lost everything.
Jan Eglin, the former United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator, the man once described as the world's conscience, joins us today to discuss his new book, A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. Then a federal appeals court has rejected calls for a new trial for one of the world's most famous death row prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Protests are scheduled today in New York and San Francisco. We'll speak to his attorney. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Tens of thousands of Iraqis took to the streets of Baghdad Thursday to protest the ongoing government crackdown on Shia fighters loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr. More than 130 people have been killed since Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki launched the crackdown on Sadr's Mehdi army on Tuesday. Earlier today, Maliki said he would extend a deadline for Mehdi fighters to lay down their arms until April 8th. As the fighting escalated, President Bush continued to sound off on the White House theme that the violence in Iraq marks a sign of U.S. success.
This offensive builds on the security gains of the surge and demonstrates to the Iraqi people that their government is committed to protecting them. There is a strong commitment by the central government of Iraq to say that no one is above the law. This operation is going to take some time to complete. And the enemy, you know, will try to fill the TV screens with violence. But the ultimate result will be this. Terrorists and extremists in Iraq will know they have no place in a free and democratic society.
Despite President Bush's claims, reports on the ground say the U.S. military is still waging much of the fighting. According to the Washington Post, an Iraqi battalion mostly stayed on the outskirts of Sadr City as U.S. troops led the attacks. U.S. armored vehicles, supported by helicopters and drones, were seen battling Mehdi forces. U.S. gunfire was heard throughout Thursday's clashes. Mehdi army commanders corroborated the account, saying they've been mostly fighting U.S. forces in Sadr City. One senior Mehdi army member said, quote, if there were no Americans, there would be no fighting. Meanwhile, in Basra, a Mehdi army member said several Iraqi troops had laid down their arms rather than fight.
We are members of the Mehdi army. We thank the soldiers who handed out their weapons and equipment. We thank them as they did not fight their brothers in the Mehdi army. We want to tell Maliki that Basra is safe. So we ask him not to ignite the situation and the mounting number of casualties.
Anonymous U.S. officials say Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki decided to launch the anti-Sadr offensive without even consulting Washington. Administration officials are said to be struggling to understand the situation on the ground. The violence also continued to hit the U.S.-controlled Green Zone. On Thursday, an American contractor was killed by one of 12 mortar rounds fired inside the zone's heavily fortified walls. Meanwhile, the death toll from Wednesday's U.S. bombing in the town of Hilla remains unknown. Witnesses have reported anywhere between 10 and 80 casualties. A local resident said Hilla had not been used for insurgent activity.
What is the reason behind attacking us? We did not fight them or attack a police center or military base. We did not threaten anyone or participate in demonstrations. No military actions in our area.
In other Iraq news, a newly disclosed memo is warning of deplorable conditions at a prison in Fallujah. According to Consortium News, Western Iraq U.S. Commander Major General John Kelly writes, the jail is so overcrowded and dirty, it does not meet minimal standards of hygiene for human beings. U.S. Marines oversee operations of the prison. More than 900 prisoners are said to be housed at the jail, even though it's supposed to hold just over 100. Meanwhile, the British government has admitted its forces tortured 9 Iraqi prisoners in 2003. The admission could lead to compensation payments to the 8 surviving prisoners and the family of the 9th, who died from beatings by British jailers. The slain victim, Iraqi hotel worker Baha Moussa, suffered 93 injuries to his body. Moussa was 26 years old, the father of 2 children. His wife died just 2 months earlier of a brain tumor. Meanwhile, back in the United States, more than 36 Democratic congressional candidates have pledged to make an immediate Iraq withdrawal a centerpiece of their upcoming campaigns. The proposal, dubbed a responsible plan to end the war in Iraq, would still keep troops in Iraq to guard the U.S. embassy. But it differs from Democratic leaders and both presidential candidates in refusing to keep tens of thousands of troops in Iraq to train Iraqis or engage in so-called anti-terrorism operations. A federal appeals court has refused to overturn the conviction of imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal and rejected his call for a new trial. However, Thursday's long-awaited ruling says Abu-Jamal, on death row for 26 years, deserves a new sentencing hearing because of flawed jury instructions. The latest decision from the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals emphasizes a lower court in Pennsylvania can now either give him life without parole or convene a new sentencing jury that will decide between the death penalty and life without parole. Abu-Jamal was convicted for killing a white police officer following a controversial trial in 1982 before a predominantly white jury. In Alabama, former Governor Don Siegelman has been ordered released from jail while he appeals a conviction on corruption charges. Siegelman is currently serving a 7-year, 4-month prison sentence on charges of bribery, conspiracy, and mail fraud. Critics say he's the target of a political witch hunt. More than 50 former state attorneys general have called for a congressional investigation into Siegelman's case. The release was ordered just hours after the House Judiciary Committee said it would call Siegelman to testify over whether his prosecution was politically motivated. Meanwhile, in Puerto Rico, Governor Aníbal Acevedo Vila has been charged with 19 counts in a campaign finance probe, charges Acevedo says could be politically motivated. The indictment also names 12 others in his popular Democratic Party. Acevedo has previously accused prosecutors of targeting him for his criticism of the 2005 FBI killing of Puerto Rican militant independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rias. Israel is being accused of carrying out new extrajudicial killings of Palestinians in the occupied territories. On Thursday, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem said Israeli troops deliberately murdered 4 Palestinian militants in Bethlehem earlier this month. Sadit Mikhali of B'Tselem says Israeli troops made no effort to arrest the victims.
According to the Israeli High Court, it is not permissible to intentionally kill a Palestinian suspect if there is a possibility of using less extreme measures, such as arresting and trying him. Based on our research, it appears that the forces on this operation acted as if it was an assassination operation. They did not make any attempt to arrest the 4 suspects, but immediately opened fire at them, and following that, confirmed the kill by firing at them again after the operation was over.
The March 12th attack broke a temporary 5-day tacit truce between Israel and Palestinian militants. In Pakistan, a visiting U.S. delegation faced allegations Thursday of trying to pressure the new Pakistani government into supporting the so-called war on terror. Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte and Assistant Secretary of State Richard Boucher arrived in Pakistan this week just before the swearing-in of the new Prime Minister, Yousaf Raza Gilani. The trip has been seen as a sign of U.S. meddling, coming before Pakistan's new cabinet has been named. Speaking in Karachi, Negroponte tried to dismiss the speculation.
This suggestion that somehow Pakistan, that we expect Pakistan to carry out activities on our behalf and at our behest that are not in Pakistan's interest is simply wrong. So I think that anything that is done in this area has got to be in our mutual interest and judged to be of mutual benefit. And, of course, we will respect whatever decision is taken by the Pakistani authorities in that regard.
Negroponte spoke hours after the Washington Post revealed the U.S. has increased military attacks against what it calls al-Qaeda targets in Pakistan. Amidst concerns, Pakistan's new government will try to limit future U.S. operations. U.S. military aircraft have struck three targets over the past 2 months, killing around 45 foreign fighters near the Afghan border. Civilian casualties are unknown. In Tibet, the Chinese government allowed in a group of foreign journalists Thursday, the first since unrest broke out earlier this month. In Lhasa, a group of monks stormed a Chinese government news briefing and accused China of lying about the situation on the ground.
They just don't believe us. They think we will come out and cause havoc, smash, destroy, rob, burn. We didn't do anything like that. They are falsely accusing us.
All monasteries in Lhasa remain closed amidst a large deployment of Chinese forces. Back in the United States, the Pentagon's ordered a complete inventory of the nation's nuclear arsenal in the wake of the recent admission four nuclear parts were mistakenly sent to Taiwan in 2006. It was the second major nuclear blunder for the military in the last 6 months. Last year, the Air Force unknowingly flew nuclear warheads between North Dakota and Louisiana. And on the campaign trail, both Democratic candidates gave major addresses Thursday to tout their economic policies. In North Carolina, Senator Hillary Clinton called for a new federal program to retrain laid-off workers. Clinton said she would stand up to corporate interests.
The oil companies, the predatory student loan companies, the insurance companies, and the drug companies have had 7 years of a president who stands up for them. I will be a president who stands up for all of you. And it is past time that we set our priorities straight and level the playing field for the middle class and against the corporate special interests. It's time for a president who is ready on day one to be the commander-in-chief of our economy.
Meanwhile, here in New York, Senator Barack Obama called for an additional $30 billion in federal economic aid and said he would increase regulation of financial markets. Obama also criticized Republican candidate John McCain for advocating a limited federal role in the economy.
John McCain recently announced his own plan, and unfortunately, it amounts to little more than watching this crisis unfold. While this is consistent with Senator McCain's determination to run for George Bush's third term, it won't help families that are suffering, and it won't help lift our economy out of recession.
Obama was speaking at the Cooper Union. I had a chance to briefly interview him as he was shaking people's hands after he left the stage. I asked Obama why he's not calling for a total withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq in accordance with the 70% of Iraquis who say they want the U.S. out.
Senator Obama, quick question. 70% of Iraquis say they want the U.S. to withdraw completely. Why don't you call for a total withdrawal?
Well, I do, except for our embassy. I call for embassy and protecting our civilian contractors.
You said a residual force, which would be
I don't think that you've read exactly what I said. What I said is that we do need to have a strike force in the region. It doesn't necessarily have to be in Iraq. It could be in Kuwait or other places. But we do have to have some presence in order to not only protect them, but also potentially protect their territorial integrity. Actually, I'm the one who sponsored the bill that called for the investigation of Blackwater and those folks.
But would you support the Sanders one now?
Well done.
Here's the problem. We have 140,000 private contractors right there. So unless we want to replace all of a big chunk of those with U.S. troops, we can't draw down the contractors faster than we can draw down our troops. So what I want to do is I want them out. In the same way that we make sure that we draw out our own combat troops. All right. I don't want to replace those contractors with more U.S. troops because we don't have them. All right. But this was a speech about the economy.
The war is costing $3 trillion,
yes,
according to Stiglitz,
which I made a speech about last week.
That was Senator Barack Obama at the Cooper Union in New York. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, you wrote your piece today in the New York Daily News about the governor of Puerto Rico being indicted.
Yes, well, the indictment had been rumored for actually for years now. There's been an FBI investigation and grand jury, but people were beginning to get skeptical as to whether a decision was going to be made. It finally did occur, but the extent of the indictment, I think, was what shocked people in terms of the federal government charging that the governor and not only his aides, campaign aides, but also several businessmen in Philadelphia, major Democratic Party donors, including one businessman, Robert Feldman, who was is one of the biggest campaign donors in Philadelphia to Governor Rendell, to former governor Jim McGreevy of New Jersey, to former Mayor Street. He was indicted as well, and they're alleging that hundreds of thousands of dollars in conduit contributions by people whose names were given but didn't actually give the money were funneled from Philadelphia, from the Philadelphia area, to Acevedo for his resident commissioner campaigns, as well as for his run for governor in 2004, and enormous numbers, amounts of personal expenses that corporations in Puerto Rico were paying for $57,000 in designer suits for the governor that were never reported, that they were paying for vacation trips to his children to China, for his family to Costa Rica and Florida. None of this was reported on campaign expenditures or on his income as income taxes. So it is really a pretty extensive corruption charge. Now, of course, it's only a charge at this point, and there are questions as to whether the government, the federal government, is actually intervening in Puerto Rico elections, because there is an election for governor happening in November, and this is definitely going to ruin the chances of the governor for re-election. He was already facing an uphill battle, so there are allegations that this is the federal government intervening in Puerto Rico affairs. But the indictment is pretty strong. The one I read, 27 counts, seems to have quite a bit of evidence and wire transfers, emails, and quite a bit of documentary evidence that the government is alleging.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow this story.
Yes, and now for the World Food Program has launched an extraordinary emergency appeal to raise $500 million by May 1st to close a funding gap caused by the soaring prices of food and fuel. The head of the UN agency, Josette Sheeran, warned donor nations that the World Food Program might soon be forced to cut food rations, quote, for those who rely on the world to stand by them during times of abject need. The World Food Program feeds at least 73 million people in nearly 80 nations. Today, we're joined by a former top UN official who has spent years working with the world's neediest and in conflict zones, including Darfur, Colombia, Gaza, Lebanon, Uganda, the Congo, and Iraq. Jan Egeland is the former U.N. Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and the former U.N. Emergency Relief Coordinator. He now serves as the Director General of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. Egeland is one of the only international diplomats to have ever met with Manuel Marulanda, the leader of the Colombian rebel group FARC. Egeland played an instrumental role in the secret Israeli PLO negotiations that led to the Oslo Accord.
During his time as UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, he oversaw the UN's response to the Indian Ocean tsunami, the Israel-Lebanon war, the escalation of violence in Darfur, and much more. And he's just written a book outlining his work called A Billion Lives, an Eyewitness Report from the Front Lines of Humanity. Jan Egeland joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
It's very good to have you with us. What do you think is the single worst crisis right now in the world?
Today, it's I would mention perhaps three. One is still Eastern Congo, catastrophically neglected. It was the biggest loss of lives on our watch these last 15 years. 5 million people died. Darfur has spread as a conflict and as a catastrophe to Chad and the Central African Republic, but certainly Iraq and Afghanistan is still unfolding as a hemorrhage of human life.
And in terms of the catastrophe in the Congo, as you say, 5 million people since about 1998, why has there been so little attention by the rest of the world to this crisis? And where is it right now in terms of the possibility for people in the Congo to be able to resume relatively normal lives?
But it was one of the biggest mysteries when I had this job as the Global Emergency Relief Coordinator, that we could not get enough attention to Africa in general, and especially not to French-speaking, Portuguese-speaking Africa. The Congo was an enormous war, an enormous catastrophe, and it didn't reach even the lowest levels of attention. We did a survey in my office in the UN, and I think in 2003, when it was at its worst, there were like six items on main US network news. There were 1,900 of the Michael Jackson case. And it was the biggest war of our time.
We're going to go to break and then come back. Jan Egeland is our guest. His book is called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. Back in a minute.
Get in action. United Nations organization. Get in action. We don't know where the next crisis will be. All we do know is what our eyes can see. South African crisis, Poland's crisis, Cuban's crisis, and more. Afghanistan crisis, El Salvador crisis, no Falkland crisis or no more. In the Caribbean, we need peace in the world. If we must survive, the war will only deprive us. United Nations organization, get in action. United Nations organization.
United Nations here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations on Pacific and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 150 are, and in audio and transcript form, as our full show is. As we talk with Jan Egeland, author of A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. Jan Egeland is the former UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and former UN Emergency Relief Chief. We're talking first about the Congo, one of the most underreported conflicts in the globe. The International Rescue Committee estimates as many as 5.4 million people have died from war-related causes in the Congo since 98. This, Jan Egeland, is what you had to say during your visit to the Congo in September of 2006.
This is the epicenter, really, of the humanitarian tragedy of the Congo, perhaps the worst in the world for this last decade. These women and children have been abused, have been raped, have lost everything. Some humanitarian assistance is now coming for the first time to this area to really help them. Our hope is from the UN to massively increase assistance and more than anything help them provide the peace in this area so they can return to their fertile land.
That was Jan Egeland in 2006 in the Congo. You remember?
I remember vividly. I was at a hospital called the Panzi Hospital, and around me were 1,200 physically and mentally destroyed women due to sexual violence. I mean, the sexual violence of the Congo, but also in other conflicts, like in Darfur, in northern Uganda, is rampant. and it's not reported on, really. Sexual abuse, mass rape of women is not a side effect of war. It is the war. It is the way they destroy the social fabric of the people they want to fight.
What do you think has to be done?
Much more attention, but number two, the leaders have to be held accountable. So I met with President Kabila of the Congo and said, I know you cannot have a lot of courts set up in no time, but you could fire these generals, these governors, these political leaders who let this happen on their watch.
His response?
His response was, if I am elected, I will do that. He was elected, and he didn't do it.
And the responsibility and the role of the Western powers in this, of France and Belgium, the United States, and others who have long had interests, especially in the mineral wealth of the Congo.
Well, the history is as black as it can get for the European colonialists in the Congo, in Central Africa, as it is for the West generally in Africa, I would say. Now I would give credit, actually, to the European Union and the United Nations, supported by the US, for the operation in the Congo, because there was little interest in it, there was little reporting, and still the UN force was built up, and it's bad now in Congo, but it is infinitely better than when I came on my first visit in 2003, and they were fighting all across this tremendous continent, which is Congo. Now it is more confined to the eastern strip of the Kivu provinces.
I want to turn now to Darfur. This clip is from your trip to the region in November of 2006.
And never would I have thought that the fear, the angst among the civilian population of Darfur would remain the same after 3 long years.
Do you remember where you were?
I was in the outgoing press conference in Khartoum, leaving the country. I had been on my fourth visit to the Sudan. I had been blocked twice by the government, but I made it 4 times. And Darfur is one of these outrages when you look back. It was a small conflict. It could have been contained. There was no interest, really, in investing in political pressure against the regime of Khartoum and in pushing through earlier a UN force that could have protected these civilians that were ethnically cleansed, first in the tens of thousands, then the hundreds of thousands, and then in the millions.
I'd like to ask you about another African country, Uganda, who you've also been involved there in humanitarian efforts. There's been ongoing discussions between the Ugandan government and the rebel group there, the Lord's Resistance Army, in terms of a possible peace accord. But the leader, Joseph Kony, has resisted that because he's being charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. You actually met him. Yes. You've been one of the few Europeans who actually sat down with him. Your sense of what needs to be done to achieve peace in Uganda?
Well, it is indeed a part of my resume to have met more mass murderers and warlords than most people alive, actually, including him. Mm-hmm. I went there because I wanted to tell them two things. Number one, we are watching their every move, and they will be held accountable one day for the massacres. And they do feel watched now. They often feel that we use that. U.S. satellites are watching them and whatnot, and they believe it. The International Criminal Court's indictments also helped, I think. They don't sleep well at night now, dictators, mass murderers, as they did before. And we did, after that visit, see that the cessation of hostilities held, and there was now, just days ago, the permanent ceasefire ratified. There hasn't been an attack since the summer of 2006. Hundreds of thousands are returning in this neglected conflict of northern Uganda. I hope he will be in jail one day, but of course now the main thing is to stop further fighting and massacres.
What about the fact that the U.S. has not signed on to the International Criminal Court?
Well, it is puzzling to me because the U.S. has, through its history, been a leader in fighting for human rights. I mean, my constitution, the Norwegian one, was in a way patterned after your Declaration of Independence. And it is now strange that the U.S. would not ratify several of these international agreements, which is to further the whole fight for human rights. And of course, it's a good thing that Milosevic of Yugoslavia is now facing justice. Charles Taylor of Liberia is facing justice. The genocide responsible of Rwanda are facing justice. Why not join it? I mean, it seems to be some irrational fear in Washington that the U.S. will someday be having people facing that. Well, if you don't do genocide, which I don't think you will do, you will not have anybody facing.
Back on Darfur, I wanted to talk about the question of how politics comes into your work on humanitarian affairs and play excerpts of Columbia University professor, African studies scholar Mahmoud Mamdani, discussing the conflict in Darfur. He was speaking at the Left Forum earlier this month here in New York.
From 2005, there was a dramatic fall in mortality rates in Darfur. UN sources on the ground in Darfur estimated that the number of deaths had gone down to 200 a month, or less than 200 a month. They declared that Darfur was no longer an emergency. But the UN itself continued to speak of Darfur as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and the US government continued to talk of Darfur as a continuing genocide. By the early 2007, we got huge campaigns in New York City, subway campaigns, bus campaigns, talking of 400,000 dead. Advocacy had turned into an advertisement. The campaign Save Darfur campaign was in fact led by a full-time advertising agency which was employed full-time by Save Darfur. The entire $14 million budget of Save Darfur was spent outside Darfur. Nothing went to Darfur. Well, the astonishing thing is that even after the death rates went down, not that they stayed down all the time, there was fighting. They went up, they came down, etc. But the kind of atrocious targeting of civilians that happened in 2003 and 2004 ceased to happen. Part of the credit for that has to go to Save Darfur movement. Part of the reason the Sudanese government decided to rethink its own strategy was that it wasn't paying off. The publicity that was done globally had its effect. But the problem is that having had its effect, once the violence, the levels of mortality went down, the propaganda continued as if nothing had changed. Absolutely nothing had changed. So today I believe that Save Darfur movement is one of the major obstacles to peace in Sudan.
That was Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani. Your response, Jan Eglin?
Well, I do not agree with this professor. I've been to Darfur many times. It is true that we were very successful with U.S. food, U.S. support, to embark on the biggest humanitarian operation any place at the moment. 12,000 humanitarian workers, some 1,000 trucks is involved in this. But listen, we keep people alive, we do not protect them. That's the whole problem of our generation in many ways. We have become effective in putting band-aids on wounds, but we do not heal the wound. This is the safe areas of Bosnia all over again. The people of Srebrenica was fed every day by Norwegian courageous civilian convoys until they were massacred. In Darfur today, there are increasing violence. More villages are again being torched. Nothing has been solved as such.
Speaking of one of the unsolved battles that's going on in the world, Colombia, you've also been there. You've been, again, one of the few people who's actually met Manuel Marulanda, the legendary Colombian FARC leader known as Sure Shot. And you actually, at one point, were able to convince the FARC leaders and government officials to come to Norway to engage in negotiations and then ended up falling apart. Why has it been so difficult to achieve any kind of a solution to that civil war, which has cost more than 30 years, now 40 years going on, that civil war, has cost so many lives in Colombia.
Now, again, one of the paradoxes, really, we're now in New York, where there is very good attention to Darfur, but very little to the Congo, and very little in Colombia, which is much closer than Darfur. And in Colombia, there are as many displaced, 2 million, as there are in Darfur through this civil war. It's been gone on for 44 years now. Manuel Marulanda has been fighting for 44 years. The other leader, Gavino, the head of the ELN, whom I also met, has been fighting equally long. I think there's been too little pressure on the parties to go to the negotiation table and end it, and they have too much interest, the guerrillas and the paramilitary forces, to continue it because they are drug-fueled. They have, from the narcotics industry, money to continue. It has to end. We have to push for an end.
But what happened when you brought them to Norway and you actually got them involved in discussions there?
It was fantastic because I had six commanders of the FARC out there with the government. Three or four of them had never been out of the jungle before, and then they were suddenly in Scandinavia, in Paris, in France, etc., where we said, listen, the Cold War is over. See for yourself. Here, socialists, conservatives sit next to each other in parliaments, and they bargain for improvements for the working class that you say you're fighting for. The people went back, I think, pretty converted. They met their old comrades there, and they were asked to put all the clothing, all the belongings from Europe in a pile, and it was torched to avoid tracking devices, and then they were made to retort all the conciliatory statements of Scandinavia. And the leader of that delegation, Raul Reyes, whom was my interlocutor for years, was the one killed 3-4 weeks ago in Ecuador in the Colombian insurgent there.
Let's go to a clip of Raul Reyes. He was interviewed by Mario Murillo in 1996.
For peace, there has to be a policy that comes from the state. That means there has to be guarantees for the insurgency to sit with the government and to discuss about the new Colombia we should all construct. Right now, there are no guarantees. Right now, continued threats against the leaders of the guerrilla movements, the proliferation of murderers and massacres continues.
Information is still coming out right now about how that massacre or killing took place, with the Colombian government going over the border into Ecuador. Now the question of how much U.S. logistical and informational support was given to make that happen. Jan Eglin.
Well, it just shows that the thing is continuing, and the bitter reality is that the FARC could have made a historic compromise. They had the opportunity to do that. Manuel Marulanda, the second man in command, El Mono Jojoy, as he's called, the military leader, and also Raul Reyes, did not do what they should have done to reach out to Andres Pastrana, the president at the time, who said, I'm willing to sign an agreement with you. Now, of the six people who came to Oslo, two are dead, Raul Reyes and Ivan Rios, also killed this last month. And the third one is in jail here in the United States for Simon Trinidad, because he was taken and extradited on drug-related abuses. They should have made the deal. They continued fighting. They thought they could do more on the battlefield. But there is no military solution for this conflict.
And what Plan Colombia means for Colombia, the U.S. pouring millions into the regime, also known for giving that regime support to the paramilitaries in Colombia?
Well, the Plan Colombia is meant to end the drug problem, which is causing immense misery also in North America. Of course, Colombia is the main supplier of cocaine to the world and to North America. What should be discussed more is, you know, maybe less, you know, Black Hawk helicopters and so on, but more, how do we end the conflict? Because it's not going to be end by helicopters or military assistance.
The situation in Gaza.
Gaza is another outrage in the world, which is getting better. I mean, there is 50% more peace and less war than 1989. But the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is among the few which gone in the wrong direction. Today, it's a ticking time bomb. And I cannot say enough how I feel that Israel and the Palestinian leadership are doing their utmost, it seems, to undermine the security for their own people for future generations.
I want to go to a clip of you in Gaza. This is what you had to say in August of 2006.
Gaza is a ticking time bomb. You cannot seal off an area which is a little bit bigger than the city of Stockholm, in extension only, have 1.4 million people, of whom 800,000 are youth and children, and then have 200 artillery shells going in there every day, virtually.
That was Jan Egeland speaking at the United Nations. What has to happen today, Israel, from Gaza to the bombing of Lebanon, which you fiercely condemned?
Well, Israel, I think, now has to realize that there has been a generation of military responses to terror. Terror, which is no other word for the missiles going into Israel. They're going randomly and they're seeking out civilians. But the military response has only made the problem worse. In Gaza, there are long lines of people who would like to volunteer to be suicide bombers. I also used the image once, you don't put hundreds of thousands of youth in a cage, give them no hope, and believe that they would be choir boys and choir girls or Boy Scouts. They will become extremists. So negotiations is the only way. And of course you have to negotiate with Hamas. Why not? I mean, I organized with friends the famous Norwegian channel between the terrorist Arafat on behalf of the terrorist movement PLO at that time, 1992, and the Israeli government, which had real leaders at the time, Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, who really said, of course, we have to reach an historic compromise. There's been enough suffering on both sides.
But in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, unlike Congo or Colombia, there has been perhaps more news coverage and attention by the world media to this conflict than any other. Yet the ability to move forward in terms of a peace agreement continues to elude all of the diplomats. To what degree is the United States sort of enabling the continued lack of resolution by continuing to so uncritically support one Israeli government after another in whatever policy they choose to engage in?
Well, of course, one of the many fallouts of Iraq and Afghanistan and 9/11 was that there was no U.S.-led push for peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It fell off the table, basically. As Europeans, as internationalists, we have to recognize that the one single most effective force for peace in the Middle East will be the United States. Europe cannot force Israel, for historic reasons, to do anything. The U.S. can put pressure on the military power, which is Israel. There's only one military power there now, and it's Israel. But they can also, with Egypt, put pressure on Palestinian leaderships, which have done their utmost to lose any opportunity, to lose any opportunity. But then it cannot only be a sustained effort at the last year of a presidency. It has to be throughout the American presidencies. So President Bush has now set the thing in motion again. The next president has to have this on top of their agenda for the next 4 years.
Iraq, Jan Egeland, you recently wrote, every year since the invasion in 2003, America spent six times more in Iraq alone than the United Nations system has had to invest on all peace, human rights, relief, development, and environmental efforts around the globe. What about Iraq right now?
Well, Iraq is, it is better overall now because of the surge, because of Shias not, well, it may change now, actually. And many of the things that were good with the surge are changing as we speak. But listen, it is costing $140, $150, $160 billion this year. The total UN budget for the whole world. and for making peace in Liberia, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, northern Uganda, big parts of the Congo, Kosovo, Nepal, East Timor, and I could go on. I mean, 10 places where the UN did make peace with allies cost like a few days of US investment in Iraq. What should be done? It's hard to say, really. But one of the things is that the region has to be brought in, the international organizations have to be brought in, and everybody has to be told in more unequivocal terms, it's in your interest to not have a vacuum in Iraq. The whole region has to fall into place again.
I want to thank you very much for joining us in our Firehouse studio, Jan Egeland, former UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and UN Emergency Field Coordinator, now serving as the Director General of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, has written the book A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. When we come back, the latest in the case of death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay with us. It's darker and deeper we go. Who knows, maybe it's all a dream. Who knows if I wake up and scream. I love the things that you give me. I cherish in my dear country, but some Jones playing on the fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq in Brooklyn at St. Anne's Warehouse. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, a federal appeals court Thursday refused to overturn the conviction of imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal and rejected his call for a new trial. However, the long-awaited ruling said that Abu-Jamal, who has been on death row for 26 years, deserves a new sentencing hearing because of flawed jury instructions. That's if he's not sentenced purely just to life in prison without parole. If he's resentenced, he will face either death or life in prison without parole. Abu-Jamal was convicted for killing a white police officer in 1982 following a controversial trial before a predominantly white jury. Protests are scheduled for today in New York and San Francisco.
We're joined now in San Francisco by Robert Bryan, the lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Welcome. PAM Africa has said this certainly is no victory. Can you explain exactly what the court ruled?
Well, good morning, Amy. And the decision in this case yesterday is really a mixed bag. On the one hand, the death penalty, the court threw out the death penalty in this case, even though Mumia remains on death row today. And if the state appeals or seeks further relief, nothing will change, at least for the present. The court did order a new jury trial on the issue of whether he should be on death row. In effect, what they did, as I said, was throw out the death penalty. So that's the good part of the decision. And having done this type of work, defending people facing the death penalty for over three decades, I can tell you any time the death penalty gets thrown out is a real victory. On the negative side, as Juan just pointed out, the jury, the court ruled against granting a new jury trial on the issue of guilt and innocence. And we were rather astounded that the court made that ruling. The silver lining to that ruling, to that dark cloud, is that it was a split court. We were before three judges. Two judges ruled against us. A third judge, Judge Ambrose, rendered a 41-page dissent in which he strongly criticized the majority, and said that racism was at work in this case, that racism, that the prosecution engaged in removing people of color, African Americans, from sitting on the jury of Mumia Abdul-Jamal. So that really gives us a roadmap, or if you will, a very bright light in the darkness of where we go from here. Because my goal is to achieve a new trial for Mumia. I want him acquitted by a jury. My intent, as I've done in so many other cases, is to see him go home to his family. And that's the bottom line.
So now with this, since this was a decision, a split decision of a panel of the Third Circuit, is it possible then to appeal to the entire Third Circuit on this decision?
Well, Juan, you've certainly been doing your homework. That's exactly what we will be doing within the next few weeks, and that is, this was a decision by 3 judges, 2-1. Now we will be going before the entire court, all the judges, asking them to review this issue. And of course, the gorilla in the room, the elephant in the room, is the racism in jury selection. The district attorney's office in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, back during, particularly during that period, in the early 80s, late 70s, and mid to late 80s, engaged in a pattern, this is judicially recognized, of removing people from sitting on juries because of race, because of the color of their skin. And when we argued this case before the 3-judge panel last May 17, I completed the argument by asking the rhetorical question, are we to believe that the district attorney did not engage in racism in jury selection in this case when it's judicially recognized it did in case after case, both before and after the trial of Mumia Abdul-Jamal? And, of course, the trial of Mumia Abdul-Jamal was the biggest trial in the history of the city of Pennsylvania. And Mumia Abdul-Jamal, as people certainly know, is a very activist writer, journalist. He's written 5 books from death row, and he's the person who's always bringing the authorities, the establishment, to task. He's very critical of abuse of government, people abusing power, of racism, that type of thing. And so racism was certainly at work in this case.
Can you talk about how the original jury was chosen? Robert Bryan, lead counsel for Mumia Abdul-Jamal.
Well, it's interesting. Judge Ambrose, in his dissent, in the first paragraph, cited a case that I presented to the court just Monday. Snyder versus Louisiana, decided last week, March 19. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, reaffirmed that the removal of even one person from sitting on a jury because of his or her race is constitutionally intolerable, unacceptable. And that is exactly what happened in this case, but not just one. The prosecution in this case engaged in a pattern of 67%, 66%, nearly 70% of their strikes of removing people who could be on the jury were people who were African American, while the defense engaged in only removed only like 20%. So there weren't that many people, African American, available to sit on the jury in the first place, and yet the prosecution struck nearly every one of them. Not all, but nearly every one. And as I said, the court said only one is enough. If one person is removed because of his or her race, and certainly there was just a pattern in this case and in other cases by that office of removing people because of their race.
And of course, Philadelphia back then, as now, had about a 45% African-American population, right?
Yes, that's true, but a far less percentage wound up being eligible to be selected, what we call in the jury venire, on the panel. And there's no question of the racism being at work in this case. What's interesting about this decision yesterday, and Judge Ambrose raised this question twice in his 41-page dissent, and that is, why is this case being treated differently from other cases? Why is the majority, the other two judges, treating this case differently? It's what we often think of as the Mumia exception, and that is, the law is one thing for everyone else, but the courts seem to strive to carve out an exception for Mamia Abu-Jamal, because obviously he's outspoken, he's very critical of the establishment, and I might say that the big issue lingering over all of this is that he is absolutely not guilty of murder.
Robert Bryan, again, to clarify, because I don't think any of these articles made clear, this three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled that Mumia Abu-Jamal must be sentenced to life in prison for killing Daniel Faulkner or get a chance with a new Philadelphia jury that would decide only whether he should be sentenced to life or get the death penalty. Is that right? And who makes this decision?
That's exactly right. And the three judges were at least unanimous on this. And as I said, this is the good side of the decision. And Mamia and I talked yesterday twice, and I broke it to him about this decision during our first conference. And we both recognized, he recognized that this was a real victory, that at least we won on the death penalty, because it not only affects him, but certainly would help other people sitting on death rows. What the court found was that the death penalty, as applied in this case, back at the 1982 trial, by a very bigoted, very racist judge, was not applied properly, that it violated very clear standards of the U.S. Constitution, and the court said that my client is entitled to a new trial on the question of the death penalty in this case. So that was a win. I mean, it's a giant step.
But still, just to understand, he either could be sentenced to life in prison or a sentencing jury would decide whether he gets life or the death penalty. Who decides whether
exactly right.
There's a sentencing jury or whether he's sentenced to life in prison?
That's decided by the jury, unless the district attorney's office hollered uncle, threw in the towel and said, well, we're not going to re-prosecute this case. Then automatically the resentence would be jury would not be necessary, would be less than death. It would be life. But assuming the prosecution continues with its zeal to try to snuff the life out of my client, we would go before a new jury of 12 men and women in Philadelphia, and that jury would decide whether it should be life or death. And I can assure you that even though the issue, if that's what we had to do, even though the issue would be penalty, we are entitled to bring in evidence of innocence, guilty of murder.
Again, just for our listeners and viewers to be clear on this, the decision as to whether to go to a jury again is made by the district attorney of Philadelphia, Lynn Abraham. Would that be the person who would make the decision?
Because
I think she's already indicated, at least in some of the reports, that she still believes that that she wants a death penalty for him, which would the only recourse she would have would be to go to a jury. So it's most likely that they will go to a jury again, to a jury trial over life in prison or the death penalty.
That is absolutely correct, Juan. That if unless they give up, we will have a new jury trial, at least on the issue of a penalty, a death penalty, or life. But again, I need to emphasize that our goal is an entirely new trial. We're pursuing that with great diligence. I've known Mamia since 1986, and the bottom line in all of this is an entirely new trial, an acquittal by a new jury so he can go home to his family. He's written 5 books from death row. I suspect if I can free him, which is what I plan to do, we will see many more books coming from the pen of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Robert Bryan, I want to thank you for being with us. Lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking to us from San Francisco. There will be protests today in New York and San Francisco around this issue. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hilda Caduce, Aaron Mata, Angelique Comet, Jeffrey Hagman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.